Chapter 32.
I'm really proud of you. Three more steps like that and we will have made it. Shall we drink to it?
Julie's forced enthusiasm strikes a responding chord inside me.
No, I don't think so.
I refuse the toast, an event which, as you can imagine, is not very common. Julie doesn't say a word. She just slowly lowers her drink, leans slightly forward, and looks directly into my eyes. It's quite apparent that she's waiting for some explanation. Under the pressure, I start to talk slowly, trying to verbalize my rambling thoughts. Julie, I really don't think that we should toast it, at least not in the way you make it sound, like toasting an empty victory. Somehow, I feel like you were right all along. What is this promotion, if not just winning a point in the rat race? My wife can express herself very clearly without even opening her mouth, which is definitely not the case for me. Here I am, rambling all over the place. Rat race. Empty victory. What on earth am I talking about? But still, why do I feel it's inappropriate to toast my promotion? The family paid too big a price for this promotion.
Alex, you're being too hard on yourself. This crisis was about to explode one way or the other. I gave it a lot of thought, and let's face it, if you had given up, the feeling of failure would have spoiled every good part of our marriage. I think you should be proud of this promotion. You didn't step on anybody to get it. You won it fair and square.
A chill goes down my back as I remember it. I was in deep trouble. My plant was under a real threat of being closed down. Over 600 people were about to join the already long unemployment lines. My career was one inch from being kissed by limbo. And on top of all that, the unbelievable hours I was putting in at work had pushed our marriage to the brink of going down the tube. In short, I was about to change from a bright rising star into an ordinary bum. But I didn't give up. Against all odds, I continued to fight, and I was not alone. Jonah introduced me to his common sense and thus very controversial approach to managing a company. It made a lot of sense, so my team enthusiastically backed me up. And it was fun, real fun. Let me tell you, the last few months were quite stormy. I think that we violated almost every rule of corporate America. But we made it. We turned the plant around. So much so that it saved the entire division. Now, Julie and I are sitting in this fancy restaurant celebrating. I'm going to head the division, which means relocation, a fact that probably contributes a lot to Julie's supportive mood. Julie, let's drink to my promotion. Not as a step toward the tip of the pyramid, but let's drink to what it really means. Positive reassurance to our exciting, worthwhile journey. A broad smile is spreading over Julie's face, and our glasses make a clear, gentle sound. We turn to our menus in a good mood. It's your celebration as much as it is mine. Actually, it's much more Jonah's achievement than mine.
You know, Alex, it's so typical of you. You work so hard, and now you want to give the credit to somebody else?
Julie, I'm serious. Jonah is the one who gave me all the answers. I was just the instrument. As much as I would like to think otherwise, that's the plain, bare truth.
No, it's far from the truth.
But...
Alex, stop this nonsense. Artificial modesty doesn't suit you. Nobody handed you solutions on a silver platter. Tell me, Mr. Rogo, how many nights did you sweat until you succeeded in finding the answers?
Quite a few.
You see?
No, I don't see. I'm very well aware that Jonah didn't simply give me the answers. As a matter of fact, during those long nights and days, considerable time was spent cursing him for just that. But come on, Julie. The fact that he elected to present them in the form of very pointed questions doesn't change a thing. Rather than continuing, Julie calls the waiter and starts to order. She's right. This line of discussion will just ruin a pleasant evening. It's not until I'm busy with my delicious veal parmesan that my thoughts start to crystallize. What was the nature of the answers, the solutions that Jonah caused us to develop? They all had one thing in common. They all made common sense. And at the same time, they flew directly in the face of everything I'd ever learned. Would we have had the courage to try to implement them if it weren't for the fact that we'd had to sweat to construct them? Most probably not. If it weren't for the conviction that we gained in the struggle, for the ownership that we developed in the process, I don't think we'd actually have had the guts to put our solutions into practice. Still deep in thought, I raise my eyes from the plate and examine Julie's face. It's as if she were waiting for me all this time.
How come you didn't think of it yourselves? To me, your answers look like plain common sense. Why couldn't you do it without Jonah's guiding questions?
Good question. Very good question. Frankly, I doubt I know the answer.
Alex, don't tell me you haven't thought about it.
Yes, I have. All of us, back in the plant, had the same question. The solutions look trivial, but the fact is that for years we've done the exact opposite. Moreover, the other plants still insist on sticking to the old, devastating ways. Probably Mark Twain was right, saying that common sense is not common at all, or something similar.
That's not an answer to my question.
She won't let me off the hook. Just bear with me. I really don't know. I'm not sure that I even know the meaning of common sense. What do you think we mean when we refer to something as common sense?
It's unfair to answer a question with a question.
Why not? She doesn't allow her lips to move. Okay. The best that I've come up with so far is to recognize that we refer to something as common sense if it is in line with our own intuition.
Uh-huh.
Which only helps to intensify your question. It only means that when we recognize something as common sense, it must be that, at least intuitively, we knew it all along. Why is there so often the need for an external trigger to help us realize something that we already knew intuitively?
That was my question.
Yes, darling, I know. Probably these intuitive conclusions are masked by something else, something that's not common sense.
What could that be?
Probably common practice.
Ah, makes sense.
I must admit that Jonah's way of leading to the answers through asking questions, his Socratic approach, is very effective at peeling away the layers, the thick layers, of common practice. I tried to explain the answers to others who needed them as badly as we did, but got nowhere. As a matter of fact, if it hadn't been for Nathan Frost's appreciation of our improvements to the bottom line, my approach might have led to some very undesirable results. You know, it's amazing how deeply ingrained those things are that we've been told and practiced, but never spent the time to think about on our own. Don't give the answers, just ask the questions. I'll have to practice that. What's the matter?
Nothing.
Don't give the answers. Definitely makes sense. Spelling out the answers when you are trying to convince someone who blindly follows the common practice is totally ineffective. Actually, there are only two possibilities. Either you are not understood, or you are understood.
You don't say.
In the first case, no real harm has been done. People are just going to ignore you. The second case might be much worse. People might understand you. They'll take your message as something worse than criticism.
What is worse than criticism?
Constructive criticism. You have a point, but it's below the belt. People will never forgive you for that.
Alex, you don't have to convince me that when I want to persuade somebody, especially my husband, that giving answers is not the way. I'm simply not convinced that only asking questions is much better.
She's right. Whenever I tried just to ask questions, it was interpreted as patronizing, or even worse, that I was simply negative. It looks like one should think twice before charging the tall windmills of common practice. Julie busies herself with the delicious cheesecake our waiter is placing in front of us. I do the same. When the coffee's served, I gather enough stamina to continue. Julie, is it really so bad? I don't recall giving you a lot of grief.
Are you kidding? Not only are you stubborn like a southern mule, you had to go and pass on these genes to your kids. I bet you gave Jonah a hard time as well.
No, Julie, with Jonah, somehow it was different. You see, whenever I'm talking with Jonah, I have the distinct feeling that not only is he ready with his questions, he's also ready with my questions. It must be that the Socratic method is much more than just asking questions. One thing I can tell you, improvising with this method is hazardous. Believe me, I've tried. It's like throwing a sharpened boomerang. Then it dawns on me. Here's the answer. This is the technique that I should ask Jonah to teach me. How to persuade other people. How to peel away the layers of common practice. How to overcome the resistance to change. I tell Julie about my last telephone conversation with Jonah.
Oh, that's very interesting. You definitely need to learn how to manage your life better. But, sweetheart, be careful. Remember what happened to Socrates. He was forced to drink poison.
I don't intend giving Jonah any poison. Julie, let me tell you, whenever Jonah and I talked about my troubles at the plant, I always felt he anticipated my response. It actually bothered me for quite some time.
Why?
When did he have time to learn so much? I'm not talking about theories. I'm talking about his intimate understanding of how the wheels are really turning in a plant. As far as I know, he never worked one day of his life in industry. He's a physicist. I can't believe that a scientist sitting in his ivory tower can know so much about the detailed realities of the shop floor. Something doesn't match.
Alex, if that's the case, it seems that you should ask Jonah to teach you something more than just the Socratic method.
Chapter 33.
Lou is my first and most important target. If I'm unable to persuade him to join me, I'm basically lost. It's not going to be easy. He's very close to retirement, and I know to what extent he's involved in his community. I take a deep breath and walk into his office. Hey, Lou, is it a good time?
Good as any. How can I help you?
Perfect opening, but somehow I don't have the guts to go straight to the point. I was wondering about your forecast for the next 2 months. Do you see any problem in us reaching and maintaining the 15% net profit? Not that it's crucial anymore, but I'd hate giving Hilton Smythe even the slightest opening to his, "I told you so."
You can sleep tight. According to my calculations, we'll easily cross the 20% net profit for the next 2 months.
What? Lou, what's the matter with you? Since when do you believe marketing's chronically optimistic outlook?
Alex, a lot has happened to me recently, but believing marketing is not one of them. Actually, my forecast is based on a slight decline in incoming orders.
So, how did you pull this rabbit out of your hat?
Have a seat. It'll take me some time to explain. I have something important to tell you.
It's clear that I'm going to hear about another devious accounting trick. All right, let's hear it.
Alex, we blame the distorted way in which product costs are calculated for giving the appearance that our net profit was only 12.8%, rather than over 17% as we believed was the case. I know that you are furious about it, but what I've found out is that there's an even bigger accounting distortion. It's tied to the way that we evaluate inventory, but it's hard for me to explain. Maybe I'll try to do it through the balance sheet.
He pauses. I wait patiently.
Maybe I should start with a question. Do you agree that inventory is a liability?
Of course. Everybody knows that. And even if we didn't know it, the last few months have shown to what extent inventory is a liability. Do you think we could have pulled off this fast response to orders if the floor had been as jammed up as before? And haven't you noticed that quality has improved and overtime has gone down, not to mention that we hardly ever have to expedite today?
Yeah. Inventory is definitely a liability, but under what heading are we forced to report it on the balance sheet?
Holy cow, Lou. I knew that the financial measurements were remote from reality, but to that extent, to report liabilities under the heading of assets, I never realized the full implications. Tell me, what are the bottom line ramifications?
Bigger than you think, Alex. I've checked and rechecked it, but the numbers do talk. You see, we're evaluating inventory according to the cost to produce the goods. These costs include not only the money we pay for the raw materials, but also the value added in production. You know what we have done in the last few months. Donovan has worked only on things that we have orders for. Stacy has released material accordingly. We've drained about 50% of the work in process from the plant and about 25% from finished goods. We've saved a lot by not purchasing new materials to replace this excess inventory, and the cash figures show it clearly. But on our books, the assets represented by inventory went down, since they were only partially compensated for by the cash we didn't have to pay out. In this period, when we were reducing inventory, all the difference between the product cost and the material cost of the reduced inventory showed up as a net loss.
Lou, you're telling me that we were penalized for doing the right thing? That reducing the excess inventory was interpreted by our books as a loss?
Yes.
Well, tell me, what was the impact in numbers?
Our actual net profit was well over 20% in each of the last 3 months.
I stare at him. I can't believe my ears.
But look at the good side. Now that the inventory has stabilized at a new low level, this effect won't disturb us any longer.
Thank you very much. Hey, Lou, when did you discover this phenomena? When did you find out that we were turning much more profit than the targeted 15%?
a week ago.
So why didn't you tell me? I could have used these facts very effectively in the plant review.
No, Alex, you couldn't have used them at all. It just would have confused your story. You see, everyone evaluates inventory this way. It's even required by the tax authorities. You didn't stand a chance. But I did discuss it at length with Nathan Frost. He understood it perfectly.
So that's what happened, you fox. Now I understand why Nathan became so supportive.
Alex, I have another issue.
Another bomb?
You might call it that, but it's sort of a personal matter. Nathan told me that he's going with Bill Peach to the group. I know that you'll need a good divisional controller, someone who has experience in the more diverse subjects that are dealt with at the division level. I'm just 1 year from retirement. Everything that I know is old-fashioned, so...
Here it comes. I must stop him before he states that he doesn't want to come with me. Once he says it, it'll be much harder to change his mind. Lou, wait. Look at the work that we've done in the last few months. Don't you think...
That's exactly what I was about to bring up. Look at it from my point of view. All my life, I've gathered numbers and compiled reports. I've seen myself as somebody who has to supply the data, as an impartial, objective observer. But the last few months have shown me to what extent I was wrong. I wasn't an objective observer. I was following almost blindly some erroneous procedures without understanding the far-reaching, devastating ramifications. I've given it a lot of thought lately. We need financial measurements for sure, but we don't need them for their own sake. We need them for two different reasons. One is control, knowing to what extent a company is achieving its goal of making money. The other reason is probably even more important. Measurements should induce the parts to do what's good for the organization as a whole. What's become apparent to me is that neither of these two objectives is being met. For example, this conversation we just had. We knew very well that the plant had drastically improved, but the distorted measurements have almost condemned us. I'm submitting efficiency reports, product cost reports, and now we both know to what extent they just lead workers and management alike to do what's bad for the company.
I've never heard Lou talk for so long. I agree with everything he just said, but I'm totally confused. I don't know what he's getting at.
Alex, I can't stop here. I can't retire now. Do me a personal favor. Take me with you. I want the opportunity to devise a new measurement system, one that'll correct the system we have now, so that it will do what we expect it to do, so that a controller can be proud of his job. I don't know if I'll succeed, but at least give me the chance.
What am I supposed to say? It's a deal! Back at my desk, I ask Fran to call Donovan in. With Lou on one side and Bob on the other, I'll be free to concentrate on the two areas I know the least, engineering and marketing. What am I going to do about marketing? The only person I appreciate in that department is Johnny Johns. No wonder Bill has decided to take him along.
Hey, Al, I'm sitting with Stacy and Ralph. We really cook it. Can you join us?
How long will it take?
No way to tell. Probably till the end of the day.
In that case, I'll pass. But, Bob, we need to talk. Can you get away for a few minutes?
Sure, no problem.
And in no time, he enters my office.
What's up, boss?
How'd you like to be responsible for all production of the division?
Wow.
Well, Bob, surprised?
You bet.
I go to pour us coffee, and he starts to talk to my back.
Alex, I don't want that job. Not now. You know, a month ago, I would have grabbed the offer with both hands. It's way beyond what I expected.
Puzzled, I turn around, a cup in each hand. What's the matter, Bob? Afraid?
You know better than that.
So what happened in the past month to change your perspective?
Burnside.
You mean he made you a better offer?
No, Alex, nothing like that. What gave me a new perspective was the way we handled Burnside's urgent order. I learned so much from how we handled that case that I'd rather stay in this plant and develop it further.
Surprises all around me. I thought I knew these people. I expected it would be impossible to convince Lou, and he almost begged me for the job. I didn't expect any problems with Bob, and he just declined my offer. It's really annoying. You'd better explain.
Well, haven't you noticed how unique the events of Burnside's order were?
Yes, of course. I've never heard of the president of a company going to thank the workers of a vendor.
Yeah, that too. But look at the whole chain of events. Johnny called you with an impossible client wish. He didn't believe it could be done, and neither did the client. And on the surface, it was impossible. But we looked into it. We considered the bottleneck availability, we considered the vendor limitations, and we came back with something pretty unusual. We didn't say a flat no or a flat yes, and then missed the due date by a mile as we used to do. We re-engineered the deal. We came back with a counteroffer that was feasible and that the client liked even more than his original request.
Yes, it was good work, especially considering what came out after that. But that was a peculiar set of circumstances.
It was peculiar because normally we don't take the initiative. But maybe there's a way to make it standard. Don't you see, we actually engineered a sale. We in the plant in production engineered a sale.
I think about it. He's right. Now I start to see where he's heading.
For you, it's not a big deal. You always look at production and sales as two links in the same chain. But look at me. All the time I'm buried out on the shop floor, thinking that my responsibility is to put out fires, and viewing the sales department as snake oil salesmen, spreading unrealistic promises to our clients. For me, this event was a revelation. Look, we give sales a rigid lead time for each product. So, if it's not in finished goods, those are the numbers they should use to promise the clients. Yeah, they deviate from it, but not by much. Maybe there should be another way. Maybe the quoted lead time should be done case by case, according to the load on the bottlenecks. And maybe we shouldn't regard the quantities required as if we have to supply them in one shot. Alex, I'd like to look into it more. Actually, that's what Stacy, Ralph, and I were doing right now. We were looking for you. You should join us. It's pretty exciting.
It certainly sounds it, but I can't allow myself to get sucked in right now. I have to continue with preparations for my next job. Tell me again what you're up to.
Well, we want to make production a dominant force in getting good sales. Sales which will fit both the client's needs and the plant's capabilities like a glove. Exactly as we did in Burnside's case. But you see, for that I have to be here in the plant. As long as we don't understand it in full, as long as we don't develop the new procedures, we have to be intimately involved with all the details.
So what you want to do is to find those procedures. I see. This is interesting, but Bob, that's not like you. Since when have you been interested in such things?
Well, since you came and forced us to rethink the way we were doing stuff. Do you think somebody needs better proof than what's happened here in the past months? I mean, here we were, running things like we'd always done it, by the seat of our pants, slowly but surely sinking. And then we took the time and re-examined it from basic principles. And look at how many sacred cows we've had to slaughter. Worker efficiency, whoops, out the window. Optimum batch sizes, there it goes. Releasing work just because we have the material and the people, that's gone as well, and I could go on and on. But look at the result. If I hadn't seen it myself, I wouldn't believe it. Yeah, Alex, I want to stay here and continue what you've started. I want to be the new plant manager. You caused us to change almost every rule in production. You forced us to view production as a means to satisfy sales. I want to change the role production is playing in getting sales.
Fine with me. But Bob, when you nail those procedures, if, will you consider taking on responsibility for all the plants in the division?
You bet, boss. I'll teach them a trick or two.
Let's drink to it.
Hey.
Who do you suggest should take your place? Frankly, I'm not impressed with any of your superintendents.
Unfortunately, I agree with you. The best would be Stacy, but I don't give it much chance she'd take it.
Why don't we ask her? You know what? Let's call both Stacy and Ralph in and discuss your idea.
So, at last you found him.
Yes, Stacy. And it definitely looks like a promising idea. But before that, there's another thing that we'd like to discuss with you. We've just agreed that Bob will take my place as plant manager. How about you taking his place as production manager?
Congratulations, Bob.
Thanks.
That's no surprise.
Stacy hasn't answered my question. Think about it. You don't have to answer now. We know that you love your job and that you don't want the burden of all the personnel problems that go with being a production manager. But we both think that you'd do a fantastic job.
Yeah, you bet.
Last night, I was lying in bed praying. I was praying that this job would be offered to me.
Hey, done.
Now that you've accepted, can you tell us why you want this job so badly?
It looks like being a material manager is starting to be boring around this plant. Not enough expediting, not enough rush calls. I didn't know that you liked that type of excitement.
No, I didn't, and I don't. That's why I was so happy with our new method, timing the release of material according to the bottleneck's consumption. But you know my fear. What happens if new bottlenecks pop up? What my people and I have done is to examine daily the queues in front of the assembly and in front of the bottlenecks. We call them buffers. We check just to be sure that everything that's scheduled to be worked on is there, that there are no holes. We thought that if a new bottleneck pops up, it would immediately show up as a hole in at least one of these buffers. It took us some time to perfect this technique, but now it's working smoothly. You see, whenever there's a hole in a buffer, and I'm not talking about just the work that's supposed to be done on a given day, but the work for 2 or 3 days down the road, we go and check in which work center the materials are stuck. And then
you expedite.
No, nothing of the sort. We don't break setups or light a fire. We just point out to the foreman of that work center which job we would prefer he gets to next.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, and it became even more interesting when we realized that we were visiting the same 6 or 7 work centers every time. They're not bottlenecks, but the sequence in which they perform their jobs became very important. We call them capacity constraint resources, CCR for short.
Yeah, I know all about it. Those foremen have become almost dependent on your people to prioritize their work. But, Stacy, you're not answering our question.
I'm coming to it. See, these holes have become more and more dangerous lately, sometimes to the extent that assembly has to deviate significantly from their scheduled sequence. And it's become apparent that the foremen of the CCRs have more and more difficulty supplying on time. Ralph was telling me that these work centers still have enough capacity, and maybe on the average he's right, but I'm afraid that any additional increase in sales will throw us into chaos.
So, here's a bomb, ticking below our feet, and I didn't even realize it. I'm pressing so hard on marketing to bring more sales, and according to what Stacy's just revealed, that might blow up the whole plant.
Don't you realize that we've concentrated our improvement efforts too narrowly? We tried so hard to improve our bottlenecks, when what we should do is improve the CCRs as well. Otherwise, we'll run into an interactive bottleneck situation. See, the key is not in the hands of the materials people. If interactive bottlenecks emerge, chaos is inevitable. We'll have to expedite all over the place.
So, what are you suggesting?
The key is in the hands of production. These techniques to manage the buffers should not be used just to track missing parts while there's still time. They should be used mainly to focus our local improvement efforts. We must guarantee that the improvements on the CCRs will always be sufficient to prevent them from becoming bottlenecks. Alex, Bob, that's why I want this job so badly. I want to make sure that the material manager's job will continue to be boring. I want to demonstrate how local improvement should be managed, and I want to show all of you how much more throughput we can squeeze from the same resources.
What about you, Ralph? It's your turn to surprise me.
What do you mean?
It looks like everyone around here has a pet project. What ace are you hiding up your sleeve?
No aces. Just a wish.
Well,
I've started to like my job. I feel like I'm part of a team.
Yep.
It's not just me and the computer anymore, trying to fiddle with inaccurate or untimely data. People really need me now, and I feel like I'm contributing. But you know what? I think that the change, at least as it relates to my function, is very fundamental. What I'm holding in my files is data. What you're usually asking for is information. I always regarded information as those sections of the data which are needed in order to make a decision. And for that, let me admit it, for most decisions my data was simply unsuitable. Remember the time we were trying to find the bottlenecks? It took me 4 days to admit that I simply couldn't find the answer. What I started to realize is that information is something else. Information is the answer to the question asked. The more I'm able to do it, the more a part of the team I become. This bottleneck concept has really helped me to move along these lines. Let's face it, today the plant obeys a schedule that's released from the computer. What's my wish, you ask? I want to develop a system that'll help in what Bob wants to do, that will shrink drastically the time and effort needed to engineer a sale, as he calls it. I want to develop a system to help Stacy manage the buffers, and even to help in managing the local improvements. I want to develop a system to help Lou measure, in a much more beneficial way, the local performance. You see, like everyone else, I have my dreams.
Chapter 34.
It's quite late. The kids are already fast asleep. Julie and I are sitting in the kitchen. We're each holding a cup of warm tea in our hands. I tell her about what happened today at the plant. She seems to be more than mildly interested. She actually claims that she finds it fascinating. I love it. Rehashing the day's events with Julie really helps me to digest it. So, what do you think?
I'm starting to see what Jonah meant when he warned you about increasing the dependency.
What do you mean?
Well, maybe I'm wrong, but you gave me the impression that you're not too sure that Lou will be able to come up with a good new measurement system.
That's right.
Is a new measurement system important for you?
Are you kidding? I don't know of another single thing which is as important as that.
So if it weren't for Jonah's refusal to continue giving you pointed questions, am I right in assuming that you'd be on the phone right now trying to squeeze more hints from him?
Most probably. It's certainly important enough.
And what about Bob's idea? Do you regard that as something important?
If he pulls it off, it'll be a revolution. It'll guarantee that we take a big share of the market. Definitely, our problem with getting more sales will be over.
And how much hope do you have that he'll be able to do it?
Not much, I'm afraid. I see your point. Yeah, I would have run to Jonah with these questions as well. And the same with the issues that Stacy and Ralph have raised. Each one of them is essential.
And how many more things will pop up when you start to manage the division?
You're right, Julie. And Jonah is also right. I felt it today as well. When each one of them spelled out their immediate dream in such a tangible form, I wondered what mine is. The only thing that kept popping into my mind is that I must learn how to manage. But where on earth am I going to find the answer to Jonah's question? What are the techniques needed for management? I don't know, Julie. What do you think I should do now?
All the people back at the plant owe you a lot. They're proud of you, and rightfully so. You've created quite a team. But this team is going to be broken up in 2 months when we go to the division. Why don't you spend the time that's left sitting with them and going over your question? They'll have ample time after you're gone to work on their problems. Anyhow, it'll be much easier for them to achieve what they want to achieve if you have the management techniques.
I look at her in silence. Here is my real, true advisor. So, I've done what my advisor suggested. I gathered them all together and explained that if each of them wants to be free to concentrate on his pet project, the division must be well-run. And in order for the division to be well-run, the division manager must know what he's doing. And since I frankly don't have the foggiest idea of how to run a division, they'd better put their brains to helping me. Thus, we're going to devote the afternoons, provided, of course, that no special emergency comes up, to help me analyze how the division should be run. I decide to start the meeting with my most naive questions. Initially, they might think that I've lost all my self-confidence, but I must expose to them the magnitude of the problem I'm about to face. Otherwise, I'm going to end up at best with some fragmented, vague suggestions. What are the first things I should do when I assume my new position?
Well, I'd start by visiting Hilton Smythe's plant.
Well, first, you should meet with your staff. You know most of them, but you've never worked closely with them.
What's the purpose of these meetings? If this question had been asked under any other circumstances, they would have taken it as a clear indication of a total lack of managerial knowledge. As it is, they play the game.
Basically, you should do general fact-finding first.
You know, like where the entrance is, where the toilets are.
I do think that meeting the people is important. Financial numbers only reveal a small fraction of the picture. You have to find out what the people think is going on. What do they see as problems? Where do we stand vis-a-vis the clients?
Who has a grudge against whom? And you also have to get a sense of the local politics.
And then?
And then I'd probably take a tour of the various production facilities, visit some of the big clients, and probably even some suppliers. You got to get the full picture.
And then?
And then you
take it from there.
How easy it is to give advice when the responsibility is on someone else's shoulders. Okay, wise guys, it's time to turn the table. Yes, What you've suggested just now is the usual line of action one takes when he's told to go there and fix it. Let me play it back for you, but in a more schematic way. Where are the colored markers? I grab a red marker and turn to the whiteboard. The first step, as you've all pointed out, is fact-finding. I hold a staff meeting, and what do I find? Oh, here we find fact A. I draw a nice red circle. And here are three somewhat smaller circles. And here is a tiny one. Oh, and there are two which are overlapping. Now, let's talk with another manager. This is very helpful. You see, this circle, he claims, is not as big as we were led to believe. And here, in the left upper corner, are two more biggies. Now, someone else reveals to us that some rectangles exist. We check, and yes, he's right. Here there is one, and here, and here, and here. We're making progress. The picture starts to unfold. What they actually see is how the whiteboard is getting the measles. It looks like one of the drawings my kids used to bring home from kindergarten. I don't think they got the message. They just seem confused. I decide to continue a little more bluntly. It's about time to talk with another manager. We must get a sense of the local politics. Oh, this is very interesting. There are also green circles and even some green stars. Here's an unidentified shape. Never mind, we'll address it later. Now, let's tour the production facilities, visit clients and even some suppliers. We're bound to reveal many more interesting facts. As I talk, the board is filled with overlapping shapes. Now that we have the full picture, we can take it from here. I finally conclude and put the markers down. Well, the board looks like a nightmare in Technicolor. I take a deep breath and pick up the phone to order more coffee. Nobody says a word. Not even Bob. Let's make it less personal. Suppose that we are a committee that's been given the ungrateful task of find out what's going on. How do you suggest we should start? They all smile. Somehow pretending that we're a committee makes us feel much better. The safety of being part of a herd. The blame will not be aimed at anyone in particular. Ralph, will you volunteer to describe the committee's actions?
Well, they would probably start in the same way, fact-finding. And as you so vividly demonstrated, they would end up in the same colorful ditch. But, Alex, is there any other way to start? How can you do anything sensible without knowing what's going on, without having the data?
Ralph is true to his profession. For him, knowing what's going on is equivalent to having the data neatly stored in his computer files.
You call this mess knowing what's going on? Oh, Alex, come on. We all know that this nonsense of fact-finding will continue until our committee runs out of ideas for gathering further facts.
Or they run out of time.
Yeah, of course. What do you think that we acting as a committee would do next? We know a committee can't submit this mess.
They finally started to realize the problem that I'm facing.
What are they going to do now? They'll probably try to arrange this monstrous pile of facts in some order.
Most likely. Sooner or later, one of the committee members will suggest organizing the shapes according to their relative size.
Oh, I don't think so. Determining the relative size of different shapes is quite difficult. They'll probably decide to organize them according to the type of shapes. They can arrange the data by circles, rectangles, and stars.
What are they going to do with those four arbitrary shapes?
Probably they'll be put in a class of their own, the exceptions.
Yes, of course. The major reason for the constant reprogramming are those exceptions that keep popping up.
No, I have a better idea. They'll probably arrange them by color, and this way there will be no ambiguity. Tell you what, let's arrange them first by color, within color by shape, and within each subclass we'll arrange them by size. This way everybody will be happy.
Count on Lou to find an acceptable compromise.
It's a marvelous idea. Now we can submit our findings in the form of tables and histograms. It'll be a very impressive report, especially if we use my new graphic package. Minimum 200 pages, guaranteed.
Yes, an impressive in-depth survey. You know, it's much worse than just wasting time producing useless, pompous reports. This over-concern about the proper way to arrange things manifests itself in other harmful ways.
What do you mean?
I mean a merry-go-round that we're all too familiar with, arranging the company according to product lines and then changing it according to functional capabilities and vice versa, deciding that the company is wasting too much money on duplicated efforts and thus moving to a more centralized mode. 10 years later, we want to encourage entrepreneurship, and we move back to decentralization. Almost every big company is oscillating every 5 to 10 years from centralization to decentralization and then back again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. As a president of a company, when you don't know what to do, when things are not going well, you can always shuffle the cards, reorganize. That will do it. This reorganization will solve all our problems.
We stare at each other. If it weren't so painfully true, we might laugh. Bob, this isn't funny. The only somewhat practical ideas I had in mind for what I should do as the new division manager were all based on reorganizing the division.
Oh, no.
Okay, then. And I turned to the whiteboard, which is not so white anymore. What is one supposed to do with this pile of colored shapes, except to arrange them in some order? Dealing directly with the pile is obviously totally impractical. Arranging the facts according to some order, classification, must be the first step. Maybe we can proceed from there in a different way from writing reports or rearranging the company, but the first step definitely must be to put some order into the mess. As I continue to look at the board, a new question starts to bother me. In how many ways can one arrange the assembled facts?
Obviously, we can arrange them by color.
Or by size.
Or by shape.
Any other possibilities?
Yes, of course. We can divide the board by an imaginary grid and arrange the shapes according to their coordinates. It'll give us the ability to construct many different arrangements based on the shape's relative position on the board.
Oh, what a great idea. You know what? I'd rather use the dart technique. Throw a dart and start arranging the shapes according to the order in which we nail them. All these methods have just as much meaning. At least my last suggestion offers some satisfaction.
Okay, fellows. Bob's last suggestion has really clarified what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with the fact that we haven't got any idea of what we're doing. If we're just looking for some arbitrary order, and we can choose among so many possibilities, then what's the point in putting so much effort in collecting so much data? What do we gain from it, except the ability to impress people with some thick reports, or to throw the company into another reorganization in order to hide the fact that we really don't understand what we're doing? This avenue of first collecting data, getting familiar with the facts, seems to lead us nowhere. It's nothing more than an exercise in futility. Come on! We need another way to attack the issue. Any suggestions? All right, enough for today. We'll continue tomorrow. Same time, same place.
Chapter 35.
Well, anybody got anything good? Any breakthroughs? I try to start the meeting off as cheerfully as possible. It's not exactly how I feel. I spent the whole night tossing in my bed, searching for any opening, which I never did find.
I think that I have one. Not exactly a breakthrough, but
wait.
You could...
Ralph interrupting? That's new.
Before we go off on a different angle, I'd like to return to where we were yesterday. I think we were too hasty in our decision that classification of data can't lead to something good. May I?
Sure.
Well, as you know, or maybe you don't, I minored in chemistry in college. I don't know much about it, but one story stuck in my mind. Last night I looked back at my notes from class, and I think you'll find it interesting as well. It's a story about a remarkable Russian named Mendeleev, and it happened less than 150 years ago.
Noticing that he's grabbed our attention, he becomes more confident. Ralph is a family man and has three little children, so he's probably used to telling stories.
Right from the start, in the days of ancient Greece, people postulated that underlying the phenomenal variety of materials, there must be a simple set of elements from which all other substances are composed. The Greeks naively assumed that the elements were air, earth, water, and...
fire.
Correct.
What a wasted talent. He's a real storyteller. Who would have suspected it?
Since then, as you know, people have proven that earth is not a basic element, but actually composed of many different, more basic minerals. Air is composed of different types of gases, and even water is a composition of more basic elements, hydrogen and oxygen. The kiss of death to the naive Greek approach came at the end of the 18th century, when Lavoisier showed that fire is not a substance, but rather a process, the process of attachment to oxygen. Over many years, out of the chemist's mammoth work, the more basic elements emerged, and by the middle of the 19th century, 63 elements had been identified.
The situation actually resembled our colored board. Many circles, rectangles, stars, and other shapes in many colors and sizes filled the area with no apparent order. A real mess. Many tried to organize the elements, but no one succeeded in offering anything that was not immediately dismissed as a futile arbitrary exercise. It got to the point that most chemists gave up on the possibility of finding any generic order and concentrated their efforts on finding more hard facts regarding the combination of the elements to create other, more complicated materials.
Makes sense. I like practical people.
Yes, Bob. But there was one professor who claimed that in his eyes, it resembled dealing with the leaves while nobody had yet found the trunk.
Good point.
So this peculiar Russian professor, who, by the way, taught in Paris, decided to concentrate on revealing the underlying order governing the elements. Now, how would you go about it?
Well, shape is out of the question.
Why? What do you have against shapes?
Out of the question. Some of the elements are gases, some are liquids.
Yeah, you're right. But what about color? You like colors, don't you? Some gases have colors, like green chlorine, and we could say that the others have transparent colors.
Nice try. Unfortunately, some elements do not have a decisive color. Take pure carbon, for example. It appears as black graphite, or more rarely as a sparkling diamond.
I prefer diamonds.
We all laugh then, responding to Ralph's gesture. I give it a try. We probably have to look for a more numerical measure. This way, we'll be able to arrange the elements without being criticized for subjective preferences.
Very good.
He's probably mistaken us for his kids.
What do you suggest as a suitable measure?
I didn't take chemistry, not even as a minor. How would I know? Maybe something like specific gravity, electrical conductivity, or something more fancy like the number of calories absorbed or released when the element is combining with a reference element, like oxygen.
Not bad. Not bad at all. Mendeleev took basically the same approach. He chose to use a quantitative measurement that was known for each element and which didn't change as a function of the temperature or the state of the substance. It was the quantity known as atomic weight, which represents the ratio between the weight of one atom of the given element and the weight of one atom of the lightest element, hydrogen. This number provided Mendeleev with a unique numerical identifier for each element.
A big deal. Exactly as I suspected. Now he could organize all the elements according to their ascending atomic weights, like soldiers in a line. But what good does it do? What practical thing can possibly come out of it? Like I said, children playing with lead soldiers, pretending that they do very important work.
Not so fast. If Mendeleev had stopped here, I would accept your criticism. But he took it a step further. He didn't arrange the elements in a line. He had noticed that each seventh soldier represents basically the same chemical behavior, though with increased intensity. Thus, he organized the elements in a table with seven columns. In this way, all the elements were displayed according to ascending atomic weight, and in each column you find elements with the same chemical behavior and ascending intensity. For example, in the first column of his table stood lithium, which is the lightest of all metals, and which, when put into water, becomes warm. Right below it is sodium, which when put into water flames. Then the next one in the same column is potassium, which reacts even more violently to water. The last one is cesium, which flames even in regular air.
Very nice. But as I suspected, it's nothing more than child's play. What are the practical implications?
There were practical ramifications. You see, when Mendeleev constructed his table, not all the elements were already found. This caused some holes in his table that he reacted to by inventing the appropriate missing elements. His classification gave him the ability to predict their weight and other properties. You must agree that's a real achievement.
How was it accepted by the other scientists of his time? Inventing new elements must have been received with some skepticism.
Skepticism is an understatement. Mendeleev became the laughingstock of the entire community, especially when his table was not as neatly arranged as I described it to you. Hydrogen was floating there above the table, not actually in any column, and some rows didn't have one element in their seventh column, but a hodgepodge of several elements crowded into one spot.
So what happened at the end? Did his predictions come true?
Yes, and with surprising accuracy. It took some years, but while he was still alive, all the elements that Mendeleev predicted were found. The last of the elements that he invented was found 16 years later. He had predicted it would be a dark gray metal. It was. He predicted that the atomic weight would be about 72. In reality, it was 72.32. Its specific gravity, he thought, would be about 5.5, and it was 5.47.
I bet nobody laughed at him then.
Certainly not. The attitude switched to admiration, and his periodic table is regarded by students of chemistry today as basic as the Ten Commandments.
Well, I'm still not impressed.
The biggest benefit was probably the fact that due to Mendeleev's table, people didn't have to waste time looking for more elements. You see, Bob, the classification helped in determining once and for all how many elements do exist. Putting any new element in the table would have upset the clear order.
Sorry, Alex, but that's not the case.
Yeah.
Only 10 years after the table was fully accepted, several new elements were discovered, the noble gases. It turned out that the table should have been constructed to have 8 columns, not 7.
Just as I've said, even when it works, you still can't trust
it. Calm down, Bob. You must admit that Ralph's story has a lot of merit for us. I suggest that we ask ourselves, what's the difference between Mendeleev's classification of the chemical elements and our many attempts to arrange the colored shapes in order? Why was his so powerful and ours so arbitrary?
That's just it. Ours were arbitrary and his was...
Was what? Not arbitrary?
No, forget it. That's not a serious answer. I'm just playing with
what,
words.
Wait, what exactly do you mean by arbitrary and not arbitrary? Actually, what are we looking for? We're looking to arrange the facts in some order. What type of order are we seeking? An arbitrary order that we superimpose externally on the facts? Or are we trying to reveal an intrinsic order, an order that already exists there?
You're absolutely right. Mendeleev definitely revealed an intrinsic order. He didn't reveal the reason for that order. That had to wait for another 50 years, when the internal structure of the atoms was found. But he definitely revealed the intrinsic order. That's why his classification was so powerful. Any other classification that just tries to superimpose some order, any order, on the given facts, is useful in only one sense. It gives the ability to present the facts in a sequence, tables, or graphs. In other words, helpful in preparing useless thick reports. You see, we in our attempts to arrange the colored shapes didn't reveal any intrinsic order, simply because in that arbitrary collection there was no intrinsic order to be revealed. That's why all our attempts were arbitrary, all futile to the same extent.
Yes, Ralph, but that doesn't mean that in other cases where intrinsic order does exist, like in managing a division, we can't fool ourselves in the same way. We can always procrastinate by wasting our time playing with some artificial external order. Let's face it, what do you think Alex and I would have done with the pile of facts that we suggested he gather? Judging by what we've done for so long here in the plant, probably just that, playing a lot of games with numbers and words. The question is, what are we going to do differently now? Anybody got an answer?
If we could reveal the intrinsic order of the events in the division, that would certainly be of tremendous help.
Yes, but how does one go about revealing the intrinsic order?
How can one identify an intrinsic order even when he stumbles on it?
Probably in order to answer this question, we should ask a more basic one. What provides the intrinsic order among various facts? Looking at the elements that Mendeleev had to deal with, they all seemed different. Some were metals and some gases, some yellow and some black. No two were identical. Yes, there were some that exhibited similarities, but that's also the case for the arbitrary shapes that Alex drew on the board.
They continue to argue, but I'm not listening anymore. I'm stuck on Lou's question, how does one go about revealing the intrinsic order? He asked it as if it were a rhetorical question, as if the obvious answer is that it's impossible. But scientists do reveal the intrinsic order of things, and Jonah is a scientist. Suppose that it's possible. Suppose that a technique to reveal the intrinsic order does exist. Wouldn't such a technique be a powerful management tool?
Without a doubt. But what's the point in daydreaming?
And what happened to you today?
I spent some time in the library. Do you know that Socrates didn't write anything? Socrates' dialogues actually were written by his pupil, Plato. The librarian here is a very pleasant woman. I like her a lot. Well, anyhow, she recommended some of the dialogues, and I've started to read them.
You read philosophy? What for? Isn't it boring?
You were talking about the Socratic method as a method to persuade other people. I wouldn't touch philosophy with a 10-foot pole. But to learn a method to persuade my stubborn husband and kids, for that I'm willing to sweat.
So you started to read philosophy.
You make it sound like a punishment. Alex, did you ever read the dialogues of Socrates?
No.
They're not too bad. They're actually written like stories. They're quite interesting.
How many have you read so far?
I'm still slaving on the first one, Protagoras.
It'll be interesting to hear your opinion tomorrow. If it's still positive, maybe I'll read it too.
Yeah, when pigs fly. Let's hit the sack.
Yeah, okay.
Chapter 36.
We're getting started a little late, since Stacy and Bob have to deal with some problematic orders. I wonder what's really happening. Are we drifting back into trouble? Is Stacy's warning about her capacity constraint resources starting to materialize? She was concerned about any increase in sales, and for sure, sales are slowly but constantly on the rise. I dismiss these thoughts. It's just the natural friction that should be expected when your material manager moves her responsibilities to her replacement. I decide not to interfere. If it evolves into something serious, they won't hesitate to tell me. This is not going to be easy. We are all action-oriented, and searching for basic procedures is almost against our nature, no matter how much Bob tells me that he's been transformed. So, when at last they all take seats, I remind them about the issue on the table. If we want the same movement that we've succeeded in starting here to happen in the entire division, we have to clarify for ourselves what we actually have done, in a generic sense. Repeating the specific actions won't work. Not only are the plants very different from each other, how can one fight local efficiencies in sales or cut batches in product design? Stacy is the only one who has something to offer, and her idea is simple. If Jonah forced us to start by asking, what is the goal of the company? Stacy suggests that we start by asking, what is our goal? Not as individuals, but as managers. We don't like it. It's too theoretical. Bob yawns and looks bored. Lou responds to my unspoken request and volunteers to play the game.
This is trivial. If the goal of our company is to make more money now as well as in the future, then our job is to try and move our division to achieve that goal.
Can you do it? If the goal includes the word more, can we achieve the goal?
I see what you mean. No, of course we can't achieve a goal that is open-ended. What we'll have to do is try and move the division toward that goal. And you are right, Stacy. It's not a one-shot effort. We have to constantly strive toward it. Let me rephrase my initial answer. A good job will be to start our division on a process of ongoing improvement.
Alex, you asked for an idea of how to tackle the subject. I think that we should proceed from here.
How?
I don't know. I didn't claim to have a breakthrough, just an idea.
Thank you, Stacy. We must admit that it is a different angle from the one we had so far. I point to the whiteboard that nobody has bothered to erase yet. We are stuck. Donovan's question is certainly in place. So I try to gain some momentum by cleaning the board and writing in big letters, a process of ongoing improvement. It doesn't help much. We sit in silence for a while, staring at the board. Comments?
I'm sick and tired of these big words. Everywhere I go, I hear the same thing. A process of ongoing improvement. Like, even if I wanted to forget it, I can't. Hilton Smythe's memos are all spotted with this phrase. By the way, Alex, these memos keep on coming, and more often than before. In the name of savings, at least saving paper. Can't you do something to stop it?
In due time. But let's keep at it. If nothing comes out of these discussions, then the only useful thing that I'll be able to do as the division manager will be to stop some memos. Come on, Bob. Spit out your frustrations. It doesn't take much to encourage Bob to voice his true opinion.
Well, every plant in our company has already launched at least 4 or 5 of those pain-in-the-neck improvement projects. If you ask me, they lead only to indigestion problems. You go down there to the floor and mention a new improvement project, and you'll see the response. People have already developed allergies to the phrase.
So what are you suggesting should be done? I pour some more fuel on his flames.
To do what we've done here. We here have not done any of these. We have not launched even one formal improvement project. But look at what we've achieved. No talks, no big words, but if you ask me, what we've achieved here is the real thing.
You're right. But, Bob, if we want to do the same in the entire division, we must pinpoint what exactly the difference is between what we have done and what everyone else has tried to do.
Well, we haven't launched so many improvement projects.
That is not accurate. We have taken many initiatives in shop floor procedures, in measurements, in quality, in local processes, not to mention the changes that we've made in the way we release material to production. True, we didn't call them improvement projects, but I don't believe the crucial difference is that we didn't bother to title them.
So why do you think we've succeeded where so many have failed?
Simple. They talked, we did.
Who's playing with words now?
I think that the key is in the different way we interpreted the word improvement.
What do you mean?
She is absolutely right. It's all a matter of measurements.
For an accountant, everything is a matter of measurements.
Lou stands up and starts to pace the room. I rarely see him so excited. We wait. At last, he turns to the board and writes.
Throughput. Inventory. Operating expense. Everywhere, improvement was interpreted as almost synonymous to cost savings. People are concentrating on reducing operating expenses as if it's the most important measurement.
Not even that. We were busy reducing costs that didn't have any impact on reducing operating expenses.
Correct. But the important thing is that we, in our plant, have switched to regard throughput as the most important measurement. Improvement for us is not so much to reduce costs, but to increase throughput.
You're right. The entire bottleneck concept is not geared to decrease operating expense. It's focused on increasing throughput.
What you're telling us is that we've switched the scale of importance.
That's precisely what it is. In the past, cost was the most important, throughput was second, and inventory was a remote third to the extent that we regarded it as assets.
Yeah, right.
Our new scale is different. Throughput is most important, then inventory, due to its impact on throughput, and only then at the tail comes operating expenses. And our numbers certainly confirm it. Throughput and inventory had changed by several tens of percent, while operating expenses went down by less than 2%.
This is a very important lesson. What you claim is that we have moved from the cost world into the throughput world. You know what? It really highlights another problem. Changing the measurement scale of importance, moving from one world into another, is without a doubt a culture change. Let's face it, that's exactly what we had to go through. A culture change. But how are we going to take the division through such a change?
You know, Alex, something is still missing. I have the feeling that the entire approach we took was different.
In what way?
I don't know. But one thing I can tell you, we haven't declared any improvement project. They grow from the need. Somehow, it was always obvious what the next step should be.
I guess so. We spend good time. We bring up the actions we took and verify that each one actually has been guided by our new scale. Bob is very quiet until he jumps to his feet.
I nailed the bastard! I have it!
He goes to the board, grabs a marker, and puts a heavy circle around the word improvement.
Process of ongoing improvement. Lou and his fixation on measurements forced us to concentrate on the last word. Don't you realize that the real sneaky SOB is the first one?
And he draws several circles around the word process. If Lou has a fixation about measurements, then you certainly have a fixation about processes. Let's hope that your fixation will turn up to be as useful as his.
Sure thing, boss. I knew that the way we handled it was different. That it wasn't just a matter of scales.
Do you care to elaborate?
You haven't got it?
Neither did we.
What is a process? We all know it is a sequence of steps to be followed, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So will anybody tell me what the process is that we should follow? What is the process mentioned in our process of ongoing improvement? Do you think that launching several improvement projects is a process? We haven't done that. We have followed a process. That's what we have done.
He's right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
What process have we followed?
I don't know, but we definitely followed a process.
Let's find it. If we followed it, it shouldn't be too difficult to find. Let's think. What is the first thing we did?
You know, these two things are connected.
What things?
In the cost world, as Alex called it, we're concerned primarily with cost. Cost is drained everywhere. Everything cost us money. We had viewed our complex organization as if it were composed out of many links, and each link is important to control.
Now, would you please get to the point?
Let him talk.
It's like measuring a chain according to its weight. Every link is important. Of course, if the links are very different from each other, then we use the principle of the 20-80 rule. 20% of the variables are responsible for 80% of the result. The mere fact that we all know the Pareto principle shows us to what extent Lou is right, the extent to which we all were in the cost world. We recognize that the scale has to be changed. We choose throughput as the most important measurement. Where do we achieve throughput? At each link? No. Only at the end of all operations. You see, Bob, deciding that throughput is number one is like changing from considering weight to considering strength.
I don't see a thing.
Well, what determines the strength of a chain?
The weakest link, wise guy.
So if you want to improve the strength of the chain, what must your first step be?
To find the weakest link. To identify the bottleneck. Hey, that's it. What a guy.
Ralph looks a little bent, but he is glowing. As a matter of fact, we all are. After that, it was easy. Relatively easy. It wasn't too long before the process was written clearly on the board. Step one, identify the system's bottlenecks. After all, it wasn't too difficult to identify the oven and the NCX-10 as the bottlenecks of the plant. Step two, decide how to exploit the bottlenecks. That was fun. Realizing that those machines should not take a lunch break, etc. Step three, subordinate everything else to the above decision, making sure that everything marches to the tune of the constraints, the red and green tags. Step four, elevate the system's bottlenecks, bringing back the old smegma, switching back to old, less effective routings. Step five, if in a previous step a bottleneck has broken, go back to step one. I look at the board. It's so simple, plain common sense. I'm wondering, and not for the first time, how come we didn't see it before?
Bob is right. We certainly followed this process, and we cycled through it more than once. Even the nature of the bottlenecks we had to deal with changed.
What do you mean by the nature of the bottlenecks?
I mean a major change. You know, something serious like the bottleneck changing from being a machine to being something totally different, like insufficient market demand. Each time that we've gone through this five-step cycle, the nature of the bottleneck has changed. First, the bottlenecks were the oven and the NCX-10. Then it was the material release system. Remember the last time when Jonah was here? Then it was the market. And I'm afraid that very soon it'll be back in production.
You're right. It's a little odd to call the market or the system of material release a bottleneck. Why don't we change the word to...
constraint?
We correct it on the board. Then we just sit there admiring our work. What am I going to do to continue the momentum?
Never satisfied, huh? Alex, why do you drive yourself so hard? Aren't the five steps that you developed enough of an achievement for one day?
Of course it's enough. It's more than enough. Finding the process that everybody's looking for, the way to proceed systematically on the line of ongoing improvement, is quite an achievement. But Julie, I'm talking about something else. How can we continue to improve the plant rapidly?
What's the problem? It seems that everything is sailing forward quite smoothly.
Not exactly, Julie. I can't push aggressively for more orders because we're afraid that any additional sales will create more bottlenecks and throw us back into the nightmare of expediting. On the other hand, I can't ask for a major expansion in hiring or machines. The existing bottom line results don't justify it yet.
Oh, my impatient husband. It looks like you simply have to sit tight and wait until the plant generates enough money to justify more investments. In any event, darling, very shortly it will be Donovan's headache. It's about time you allowed others to worry.
Maybe you're right.